This season, Instacart has your back to school. As in, they've got your back to school lunch favorites like snack packs and fresh fruit. And they've got your back to school supplies like backpacks, binders, and pencils. And they've got your back when your kid casually tells you they have a huge school project due tomorrow. Let's face it, we were all that kid. So first, call your parents to say I'm sorry, and then download the Instacart app to get delivery in as fast as 30 minutes all school year long. Get a $0 delivery fee with your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 an order. Additional terms apply.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front payment equivalent to $15 per month. New customers on first 3 month plan only. Taxes and fees extra. Speeds slower above 40 gigabytes. See details.
The New Statesman.
I'm Hannah Barnes, and you're listening to the New Statesman podcast. Black Rod has been summoned, the golden carriage has arrived, and the heavy wooden door has swung open on a new parliament. Yes, it's King's Speech Day. You know the drill. State opening of parliament is an archaic affair full of ancient ritual, fancy robes, and the marking of a new parliamentary year. And in this case, the first Labour government in 14 years. For us, it's the first opportunity to get a flavour of exactly what Keir Starmer plans to deliver. And that's what we're going to be unpicking today. I'm joined by our senior editor, George Eaton, and political correspondent, Rachel Cunliffe, who've both been watching the speech avidly and will be writing about it for the New Statesman. Hello, both.
Hello.
Hello.
George, bumper list of 39 bills. Going to start with an easy question. Any big surprises in this King's speech?
No, there weren't, to echo Radiohead. There were no surprises, which is just as Keir Starmer would want it. I mean, his message has been stability is change, and Labour have had quite well-developed plans. So what we have got is a sense of the tone and sort of long-term strategy of Keir Starmer's government, and then a lot more detail on some of the key policies in the manifesto. Workers' rights, public ownership, GB Energy, rail renationalisation, planning reform, house building.
Before we go through the detail of what has been announced, I mean, talking about the tone, the biggest list comes under this grouping, doesn't it, that the Labour government have put on this called economic stability and growth. But it seems the message is sticking with that. It's a government of service. It's not about self-service. It's for the country. There are going to be no quick fixes. It's a continuation of a theme we're seeing here, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, they're staking so much on growth because they haven't got big plans on tax and spend, although it'll be interesting to see how Rachel Reeves positions herself in the budget in the autumn, and because growth has been relatively poor in the UK over the last decade. So there is catch-up potential, as economists have put it. The other thing that stands out, Starmer's emphasis on service. He's been constantly repeating that line, and also his attack, probably the most in some ways political line in the statement, on taking on the snake oil of pop. When you speak to Starmer allies, they see his political career today as beating two populists, Jeremy Corbyn and Boris Johnson. But the populist dragon assumes new forms, and you're seeing the rise of reform, and that clearly is a long-term challenge to Labour. So they see the political challenge as defeating that populist threat.
Well, I was going to ask you, because who did you see that addressed to mostly? Because I've seen different commentators say, oh, it's definitely a swipe at Nigel Farage. Others say it's Boris Johnson, but you think it could be all of these people at once?
I think it could be all of them plus populists on the left. I think essentially over the last decade, you've had people on the left and right who offer what some would see as quick, seductive solutions that might poll well, that might get you into power for a bit, but it don't actually work. And he's saying, I've got a long-term plan. It's not necessarily flashy, but it's detailed and it's going to tackle some of the long-term problems. I think the challenge for him will be weighing that up against the need to deliver quick results in some areas, given very volatile electorate and then just how many problems there are in the country.
I think it's also directed that phrase about the populace with an eye in other countries as well. Obviously, with what's going on in France and Marie Le Pen and Macron struggling with the rise of the populace there, and of course, Donald Trump in the US, we know that Starmer's Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, has been building relationships with people in Trump's team, including his pick for vice president, JD Vance, which we talked about a lot on the podcast yesterday. But I think that line as well, keeping an eye on what's happening on other countries, Britain is taking, with this election, at least so far, a quite radically different path to what we're seeing in a number of other countries that are our traditional allies. So I think there's that element of it as well.
Before we dive into the detail of what was actually the legislative agenda, there was a nod to foreign affairs in Keir Starmer's speech, wasn't there? Mentions of obviously defence, NATO, Ukraine. What did you make of that?
Security, foreign policy, defence are going to be huge issues for this government, partly because, as you say, of Ukraine, partly because of the Middle East, but more broadly the rise of Russia and China. Labour have said they want to increase spending to defence spending to 2.5% of GDP. There's not a clear timetable for that at the moment. Governments are often dominated by foreign affairs. So it could, in one scenario, make or break Keir Starmer's premiership. But it's also political. They recognise one of the reasons why Labour was out of office for 14 years was because it wasn't trusted on national security. It's seen as the first duty of government. So I think it's both a nod towards the real policy challenges that they are and also an act of sort of political reassurance.
OK, let's go through some of these 39 bills, obviously not all of them. Why don't we start with
like the 39 steps?
Why don't we start with some really interesting measures in housing, both building and protecting people in the rented sector? One particular thing has caught your eye, Rachel.
Well, what's caught my eye is a whole load of protections for renters, which we knew was going to be in there, ending no-fault evictions and ending the ability for landlords to raise the rent and essentially force their tenants to leave by unreasonable rent hikes. But also, crucially for me as the New Statesman's resident pets correspondent, provision in there saying that renters should be allowed to keep pets in rental properties. And that's actually something that I remember speaking on a panel about years and years ago with a Tory MP heading it up, saying it is absolutely outrageous that you can't have a pet if you're a renter. I don't think it's the most important part of this King's speech, but I do think there is a sense here that Labour recognises that house building, really important, home ownership, really important, but also there is an entire generation, and it's not just young people, but who are not going to be able to ever own a home. And if you have a rental market that is very fractured, very insecure, that prevents people from knowing that they're still going to have somewhere to live in a couple of months. They can't take jobs, they can't plan families, they can't even, you know, start businesses, anything like that. That is going to have a huge number of knock-on issues on productivity, living standards, entrepreneurialism, public sector, workforce issues, like all of that. And so prioritising rental reform alongside house building is really important. And I would say that being able to keep a pet is a key issue of mental health and well-being. I think George would agree. You got cats.
Yes, two
yeah,
cats.
Yeah, we've all got cats here.
Oh, you're both cat people.
We're both cat people. Hannah hates animals. Oh. Even though she's sitting there in an animal print top.
Hate animals. I loved my cat growing up very much. Anyway, swiftly moving on. I don't want to be cancelled. George, plenty in here about public ownership, as we'd expected. We saw this during the election campaign. But run us through the details of the various measures announced today.
Yes, so no, I've written in my column in the magazine this week, I think this is the most interventionist Labour government since Harold Wilson. It's also the most class conscious one. And you saw that with the big agenda on workers' rights. But as you say, public ownership is really returning as a tool of economic policy. No, in the post-crash era, you have seen public ownership used, but it's tended to be in an emergency fashion. Banks are going under or a rail operator's gone under, right? The state steps in then. The difference with this government is that they believe in using the state to direct the economy. Most obvious example of that is GB Energy, and the small print makes clear that it will own, manage and operate energy projects, that it's not just going to be a sort of investment vehicle. 8.3 billion of capitalization, so it's a relatively small amount at first. But this is really designed to position Britain as a player in areas where it has big potential, such as offshore wind, but which are currently dominated by state operators, some other European countries. Then the railways. So rail public ownership, hugely popular, has been popular for a long time. How are they going to pay for it? Well, they've said they will take contracts back in-house as they expire, or if contractors break their obligations. Now, in some ways, this is building on something that you've been seeing happen in quite a piecemeal fashion, where, as I say, when contractors have defaulted, they've been taken back in by the state. But this is going to be done in a much more organized way, and you're going to have Great British Railways, this new guiding mind for the railways. The question for commuters in practice will be, does this make a difference? I think there are probably a lot of people who are hoping, because of public ownership, ticket prices will come down. That's not going to be the case. The question will be, are they more affordable in the long term? Is the fare system far simpler and more user-friendly? And do people have a better experience on the railways in general in terms of arrival times? And those things do matter to people's perception, I think, of the country, because the state of the railways, Louise Hague, actually, the transport secretary, made this point when I interviewed her. They're seen as something, as a sort of barometer for national well-being. People say, look, the railways didn't used to be like this. It's a mark of national decline. So I think if Labour can turn that around, that will do them some good. The final thing I mentioned is they've ended the ban on public ownership for buses, which again is part of having
a better buses bill.
Yeah.
But this is really important. Buses are so vital, aren't they, to many people with poorer transport links than we're privileged to have here in London. I mean, this is a great move.
Yeah, and one of the issues with buses is it's not always clear when bus routes get axed, whose responsibility that is. Is that the local council? Is it to do with something that the local MP can try and fix? Is it the private company that has sort of taken over the bus route? I remember Anoush did a really interesting piece in North East Somerset, what was the constituency of Jacob Rees-Mogg before he lost his seat, about this missing bus route that was crucial for people getting to work, for elderly people being able to go into town and pick up their medications and all of this stuff, and how that the bus route had been axed and no one would take responsibility for whose decision it was. So part of this bill, my understanding of it, George, is that it's going to clarify some of those systems and enable local areas to take back control, to borrow a term that we first heard somewhere else, of their local transport infrastructure.
Absolutely, yes. And Hannah, you're completely right. Buses for a long time didn't get much political attention, and that's changed. And I think it's part of, you know, Rachel Reeves has talked about the everyday economy. I actually referenced this in my column this week. This Harold Wilson sent a list to his cabinet in 1974 of little things that mean a lot. And he used examples such as local breweries or having May Day as a bank holiday. And it's about trying to connect with people's everyday experience, that transport, housing, these are so important. And a lot of the higher level stuff around the economy and trade deals, it's important to the overall national economy in terms of GDP, but it's about connecting with people's everyday experiences.
There's been enormous praise I've seen from the trade unions in response to the Employment Rights Bill. George, this strikes me as quite radical if you look at some of the details. So people to get all kinds of rights, whether that's parental leave, sick pay, protection from unfair dismissal from day one of employment. It's going to be unlawful to sack a woman who has had a baby in the last 6 months after she returns to work, banning exploitative 0 hours contracts. Is this one of the more radical measures, do you think?
Definitely. It's a big step change from what we've seen, where workers' rights have been weakened by Conservative governments. And this is a much more interventionist approach. And why are Labour doing it? Well, partly it is a matter of social justice, and Labour is, to state the obvious, the party of the trade union. So it's always going to have a focus on rights at work. But the interesting, I think, underexplored areas, they think this will be good for growth, because too many companies, they think, rely on casual, cheap labour rather than investing in technology and capital. And also because workers don't change job actually enough, in their view. That's one of the things that sort of drives up productivity. One of the best ways people can, you know, improve wages is to change job. But part of the reason people have been doing that less in the UK is because they don't have the rights from day one. So this is designed to give workers the security to say, look, I'm going to go to this attractive new company because I'm not worried about not having, you know, rights to sick pay and parental leave. So there is a sort of economic logic behind it, as well as the long-standing sort of Labour tradition of workers' rights.
It's also the one bit in the King's speech, okay, maybe one of two bits if you include devolution, but it's the one bit that is the legacy of levelling up. They've changed Boris Johnson's levelling up agenda into this idea of levelling up workers' rights, and it's part of this idea that if you're in work, it should pay, essentially, which has frustrated some people on the left who argue that it shouldn't just be about workers, or this the emphasis on working is not necessarily the right message to send for people who can't work for various reasons. I've seen a lot of sort of criticism of Starmer's Labour from the left on that ground, on the emphasis on work. But that's actually been crucial to, I think, to Starmer's being able to push through some quite radical moves, which could be spun as being anti-business or extra burdens on business. Certainly Rishi Sunak, before the election, was trying to spin those as extra burdens on business, and to turn that round and go, it's not anti-business, it's pro-economic growth, but it's also pro-worker, and you don't have to choose between the two.
Well, and you mentioned devolution, and actually Keir Starmer, obviously meeting with the regional mayors on day two, I believe, he's making good on that, isn't it? There's a bill about giving more powers to these mayors and combined authorities, George.
Yes, look, Keir Starmer said a phrase which stuck in my head at his first Number 10 press conference, which was that those who have skin in the game know what's best for their local communities. And I think devolution has been a success. Look at the transformation you've seen in terms of Greater Manchester, London, all areas. You know, I suppose Sadiq Khan and Andy Burnham have been the most prominent. But that, I think that's seen as one of the good things that the last Conservative government did. George Osborne obviously invested a lot of political capital into that. And I think that agenda stalled a bit. And this is an attempt really to inject new life into it. And particularly because there's not a huge amount of money going around, Labour are looking at what is their offer to the mayors. And it is going to be more power, because there are decisions clearly that are best taken at that level. And even after devolution, England, the UK, remains one of the most centralised countries in Europe.
All of that is true, and Starmer has said all of those things, and Starmer has kicked off being Prime Minister by having those meetings with the mayors, including, he said, with Conservative ones. Ben Houchen, he had a one-on-one meeting with. But at the same time, in the planning section of the King's speech, there's a bit about not allowing objections from a minority of vocal local people who want to block new development, whether it's housing or power stations or pylons or whatever, not letting that get in the way. So I don't think those two things are necessarily mutually incompatible, but I will be really interested to see the balance of those two things. A centralised, mission-led Westminster government saying, we need this national infrastructure, we need this housing, sorry, local objectors, it's going to happen. And then at the same time, devolving powers to the mayors on a regional level saying, you've got skin in the game, you know what's best. I think there could be some tension there down the road.
After the break, what wasn't in the King's speech? And if you value our podcast, please do consider giving us a nice review on Apple Podcasts. Make sure you hit the follow button in your podcast app so you can get new episodes as soon as they're released. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Ryan Reynolds here for, I guess, my 100th Mint commercial. No, don't. I mean, honestly, when I started this, I thought I only have to do like 4 of these. I mean, it's unlimited premium wireless for $15 a month. How are there still people paying 2 or 3 times that much? I'm sorry, I shouldn't be victim blaming here. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch. Whenever you're ready.
$45 upfront payment equivalent to $15 per month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Taxes and fees extra. Speeds slower above 40 gigabytes. See details.
I did feel a little sorry for members of the House of Lords who had to sit there listening to the King describe their erasure from the legislature, that they would be booted out slowly but surely, and their rights to sit and vote be removed.
So the hereditary peers have lost their rights to sit and vote in the House of Lords, but the planned retirement age of 80 that I remember, Hannah, you were quite shocked about in one of those podcasts during the election.
Only when I thought it applied to me.
This trust reportedly called for a state pension age of 80.
So. Yeah, so you weren't panicking for no reason, Hannah. But that House of Lords retirement age change has been parked.
It wasn't in there.
Are you surprised, George, that it wasn't in there? Because that was in the manifesto.
It was. It's a good point. And the one theory is that it's Biden-related in parts. Another theory is that some of the new Labour peers who have been posed are over 80. So I slightly go back on sort of no surprises. There were a few in terms of at least things that were missing. So there was that. Also reducing the voting age from 18 to 16, automatic voter registration. They weren't in there. That actually, when I step back, doesn't necessarily surprise me too much because you've just won an election. And so to say, oh, we're going to start changing the franchise, I'm not sure it's the sort of best look immediately after. It's almost as if to say, well, what was wrong with the terms on which you were elected? Maybe it's something to do more a midterm project, looking ahead to the next election, rather than changing the rules when you've only just arrived.
Well, the problem with that, if you wait too long and you don't have the political capital to do it, big constitutional changes, they're the kind of thing that you do need to have momentum in order to do, just because of how contentious they are. So I feel like we've seen versions of this before where various parties have proposed quite radical constitutional changes and then come into government and gone, yeah, we're going to do that later. So I'm not sure if I'm certain that some of those things are coming back, but I guess we'll see.
That is a good point.
Interesting that this Labour government have chosen to follow through and see to the end Rishi Sunak's really pet project of trying to eventually eradicate smoking from the younger generation with a progressive age ban on buying cigarettes and vaping.
Yeah.
Pretty interesting to see that. He'll be pleased, I imagine.
I think there are a couple of reasons behind that. One of them is that Wes Streeting and Keir Starmer, they know that the NHS is in huge trouble, and they know that preventative healthcare, preventative public health measures that stop people developing the conditions that mean they end up in A&E and overwhelming the system, that is a key part of trying to get the NHS back on track. And smoking is responsible for a vast number of diseases and conditions. And so you can see why, as a public health measure, they would want to continue with that. Obviously, it was a measure that Labour said they supported when Rishi Sunak first announced it at a Conservative Party conference, even when most of his own party, or much of his own party, I should say, was quite anti it. So it does fit in with the Wes Streeting NHS public health agenda. Also, it's free, or it's relatively inexpensive. Obviously, you lose the tax from tobacco products, but governments that don't have very much money love big measures that don't cost very much. So there's that aspect to it. I also wonder if there's a sense in which Starmer knows that there are certain issues, particularly around social care, that they're going to need cross-party consensus and support on. And one of the reasons that we haven't been able in the last 3 or 4 decades to come up with the serious reforms on social care is because everyone agrees that we need cross-party consensus, and then it becomes very contentious whenever any party starts to do it. So I wonder if there's a sense of offering the olive branch and giving Rishi Sunak a little bit of his legacy to say we're not going to be party political about things, and hoping that that stores up some credit so that when they come up with plans for social care and they would like the Conservative support, there's at least an open conversation. That I'm not sure if it will work or not, but I get the sense that that is in a way what that measure is meant to be trying to do.
I want to ask you both if there's a measure that's received less attention that's caught your eye. I mean, there's two that I think are really interesting. So there's one which is as yet unnamed, but this is about bringing in a legal duty of candour to public servants. And I think that's really interesting. It's been dubbed a Hillsborough law because of obviously the disaster at Hillsborough. But we saw the same thing in the contaminated blood scandal. This absolutely atrocious scandal that took place over decades, of which politicians knew, civil servants knew, health officials knew. So that's really stood out. And I think a couple of things in the justice realm as well. There's going to be an official requirement that people who commit crimes, they have to attend their sentencing. We've seen a couple of high profile cases where they refused to recently. And also this stripping parental rights from child sex offenders. I think those who have campaigned in that area would welcome that. George, is there a bill that's not getting as much attention that stood out for you?
Well, I think one thing that's interesting is that they're going to activate what's called the socioeconomic duty of the Equality Act, which sounds quite sort of wonkish, but it basically means that all public bodies, councils and other organisations will have to take sort of class and economic factors into account when making their decisions, which might have led to some sort of legal appeals against some austerity measures. And it's something that the Conservatives didn't do for obvious reasons. But it's another example of how Labour quietly are going to be changing legislation to have much more of an emphasis on class and economic inequality. Now, that's partly because they're not actually doing lots of redistribution as things stand. They're not, as things, they're scrapping things like the two-child limit, although that is going to come back around. But what they are doing is trying to equalise laws through workers' rights, as discussed, but also through changes such as this. And the intention is also for higher growth to benefit everyone. But I think that's one thing which hasn't had much attention, but it is a significant shift because we've seen the impact of the Equality Act in other areas. This is going to put the focus back on economic inequality.
I think that's a really key one that hasn't got much attention. For me, it would be a measure that it's not its own bill, but there's a bit in there about councils having to keep a register of children who are out of school, including who are homeschooled. And that is one of the issues that people who work in the education sector talk about as the next big scandal. Children who are being homeschooled, children who are being taught in school-like environments that are not registered with Ofsted, and that Ofsted has no power over, whether that is religious schools or community-based schools. And we've seen after COVID very high levels of absenteeism, a whole load of reasons behind that. But I think just councils having to keep track of where are these children and what education are they being offered, rather than just trusting parents who are like, yeah, I'm homeschooling. I think that's really important. And it's something that isn't really party political, but is one of those issues that routinely comes up if you talk to people in the education sector.
I mean, so much so that it's absolutely staggering, really, that we don't do that already.
Yeah.
That's a conversation for another day.
And it's absolutely staggering that there are school-like environments that children are attending that the local council at Ofsted have no right to go in and find out what is being taught in there, because they're not registered in the system.
I mean, I add to the list of things that weren't in the speech, but I guess it's not surprising at all, but the SNP have obviously attacked on it, is no overturning of the two-child benefit cap. Before we go, just guys, take us a bit behind the scenes of today, because in fact there's some nice pictures circulating of Keir Starmer, Angela Rayner, Rishi Sunak, Oliver Dowden, all having a bit of a laugh, really.
I really like that. There's footage of them smiling and chatting as they walk in. And actually, I think we've said before that Rishi Sunak seems so much more relaxed and gracious and statesman-like now he's opposition leader, rather than with all the stresses that come with being prime minister. Maybe he's just relieved that it's not his job to hold his party together. But I think that it is nice to see politicians as people who might have very different political views, but who generally, by and large, share the same common aim, which is trying to make life better for people in this country. And obviously a big set piece event like the King's Speech, it's really setting the Commons, the MPs, up against the Lords. And so it kind of makes everyone, all the MPs, together in that sense as they all traipse through Parliament. But it's very it's very archaic, but it's also sort of a reminder that people in the Commons almost have more in common with each other than they do in the Lords in the other house. Obviously, in practice, it doesn't work out that way, but I think that's visually sort of what it's meant to represent.
And George, I mean, what happens now in parliamentary terms?
So Labour will have to decide which bills get priority, but they do want to get a lot of legislation through. So recess is going to be quite late. I think it's going to be from the shorter one than normal, from the 31st of July until 2nd of September. And MPs are going to, the House is going to sit on Friday to have an extra day to get all of this legislation through. Now, with a big majority, 172, your Keir Starmer's not really going to have to worry too much about winning the votes, but people will be watching, looking for signs of early rebellions, as and when there is a vote on the two-child limit, whether it's an opposition motion, whether it's an amendment. That will be an early flashpoint. Why is that getting so much attention? Because the stats clearly show it's driving up child poverty. And also there's a big coalition of support actually from left, centre to right now opposed to it. There was an early rebellion in the New Labour era in 1997 when they were cutting benefits for single parent families. I think you had nearly 50 Labour MPs rebel on that. So even when you've got this big majority, you do get these rebellions. And sometimes people feel free to rebel because there's no worry about the government losing the votes. So that will happen. Then autumn, you're going to have the first budget, which I think is when you really get the key detail on tax and spend. Rachel Reeves commissioned this review of the public finances almost to give her the political space to then take some tough early decisions in the budget. As you say, Rachel, on constitutional reform, in a sense, the earlier you do it, the easier it is. And I think the same applies to tax and spend measures. So it's going to be an incredibly busy time in Parliament. In terms of legislation, it's a long time since we had a government with this level of ambition in terms of the number of bills, and also in some sectors, a real sort of step change from the last 14 years.
Yeah, Rishi Sunak actually stopped putting legislation through the Commons in any meaningful sense quite a while ago. And it was, I remember when we talked about the last King's speech in autumn, we were commenting on how light it was and how we weren't sure what they were going to do with all their parliamentary time. So this is really a step change. Before we go, can I just mention how much I enjoyed the fact that there's a measure in the King's speech about giving the OBR the right to sense check tax and spend legislation. It's called the Office for Budget Responsibility Bill, or the Budget Responsibility Bill. And one person who is absolutely not a fan of this is Liz Truss, who tweeted that it was going to be disastrous. She's obviously off in Milwaukee, the Republican National Convention, living her best life. And I did enjoy a couple of tweets retweeting that and suggesting she write to her MP about it. Obviously, in the seat of Southwest Norfolk, one of the safest Conservative seats, they do now have a Labour MP.
And with that, we bid you farewell. Thank you for listening. If you've got a question for us about either what you've heard or anything about British politics, please send it to us at newstatesman.com/youaskus, and we'll do our very best to answer it. If you're listening on Spotify, scroll down on the episode page and leave a reply. Or if you're watching on YouTube, just leave a question in the comments. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Hannah Barnes, and my colleagues George Eaton and Rachel Cunliffe. This episode was produced by Chris Stone, and the video editors are Grace Braddock and Rob Lemaire.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
To enjoy more of our analysis of politics, news and events, plus world-class literary and cultural reviews, subscribe to The New Statesman from just £2 for the first 2 months. You'll get unlimited access to all of The New Statesman's online content, ad-free podcasts and invitations to NS events. Subscribe now at newstatesman.com/save.